This last session to round off today is about the Messianic era and what it entails. We've already discussed, if you've been here, was anyone just coming for this session, not here the whole day? So most people have been here the whole day. And so we've already talked about the differences between Judaism and Christianity and what the Jewish view is of Jesus. This last session is to talk about our view of the Messianic era. We're no longer doing comparison. You can do that in your own mind, if you will. I'm here to give you over some information about what Judaism says about this period of time, which we call the Messianic era. And I'd like to divide it into a couple sections. Section number one is going to be just a picture of the Messianic age. In other words, if you can have a photograph or family photos in your photo album, or if you went on a tour of the Messianic age, what photos would be in there? What videos would you take? What would it look like if you were showing this to somebody else? Second of all, and that's going to be the bulk of what we talk about, but I'd also like to talk a little bit about how we're going to get there. And finally, if we have time, when's it going to happen already? Now, before we get started, as a way of introduction, I'd like to just ask the following question as a preface. I see that some people have left from the previous session. I see that some people have come in. Most of you have stayed on. So this question is appropriate, I think. Why should we care? Why do we care what the Messianic age is going to look like? In other words, if you're going to go on a tour of something, if something's going to happen, why not just wait till it happens? What's the purpose or benefit of having this discussion? Is it just feeding our idle curiosity? Or is there anything else going on? And maybe you have a personal answer. If you have a reason why you're motivated to learn this, I'm very interested. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Here's my thing. I certainly won't mention a rabbi's name, but unfortunately, when my father died a couple years ago, my sister went up and asked the rabbi. I thought it was a horrible answer, by the way. What happens to us when we die? He says, I have no idea. I'll let you know when we get there. I'm hoping that... seriously. When a Jew dies...
Okay, you're asking a question about death and what happens after death. Well, I that's a fascinating and important topic that Eitz Chaim often teaches classes about. That's not going to be what we cover today. So, but that's an interesting point you're making, because the point this gentleman has made is that many people, when they think of the Messianic age, they're thinking of something like that has something to do with after death, some kind of after death or heavenly type of experience, which is fine as a theory. And I'm going to leave it there as a theory. When we talk about this picture, maybe it'll start to get you towards an answer. Someone else had their hand up. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the answer to your question is not be surprised when it happens.
We don't want to be surprised. Okay.
But his question was important because Chas v'Chalilah, if you're cremated,
okay, so you're making an assumption. So far, you're making an assumption that people are... Well, you're making an assumption that Messianic age is when people have passed away are going
to
come back. I haven't got there yet. Okay, fine. Let's talk about that when we get there. Any other motivations of why you're interested in this topic?
I was thinking that Messianic age means in actual people's life it may happen, that the world will change dramatically. And what is said in Isaiah, I believe, in Isaiah, that the lion can live with the lamb, which is with peace.
And why is that interesting to you to learn about before it happens?
Because if I can still live in such a world, it will be very nice.
It gives you hope.
Yeah.
It will give you hope.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
I feel the same way. It would give me hope. Yes, ma'am.
As a human being, I think we deal more with the concrete as opposed to the abstract. We use the term picture to a little bit more for humanity's understanding.
Okay, so we want answers. We just generally want answers. We want something concrete. We want hope. Those are nice reasons. Someone else had their hand up? Yeah.
I want to know, are we approaching the time when
we can't stand the suspense. Isn't that the bottom line? We just can't stand the suspense. We want to know the answer. Does anybody here read the end of the book, the novels, before you read the whole novel, like skip to the end? I actually do that. I'm not a big novel reader. I always want to figure, let's just get to the cut to the chase here. Someone knows the answer already, right? So the reason that you laugh when I say that is because it's possible. Because we have a novel and you can flip to the back and see the answer. We don't actually have the book written yet. So we can't know for sure exactly what the ending is going to be. But we do have some very interesting, provocative traditions in our texts, including the Talmud, the Midrash, the Zohar, and other texts that make predictions. And what's remarkable is, when you look at the predictions, many of the predictions look like they are on the verge of happening, or maybe already have happened. And so part of the problem we have is, what's the definition of this term? What is the definition of the Messianic Age? And maybe once we define it, together we can figure out, are we on the verge of it? Maybe it's already started. Maybe it hasn't started yet. So what, but, you know, a more fundamental question, when I ask this question, the preface question, why do we care? It really gets down to an even more fundamental question, which I think every Jewish discussion should begin with, is, what is life for anyway? What are we on this planet for anyway? What's the purpose, from a Jewish perspective, of being here, whether it's in this room or whatever, wherever else people are, and whatever you're doing? What are we here for?
To do mitzvahs.
To do mitzvahs. That sounds so religious. You know, all of our authorities that I've studied say basically the same thing in different ways. But the ultimate reason that an infinite creator created finite beings like us is in order to give to us, in order to give to us so that we should be able to be recipients of this metaphorically downward flow of goodness. That's what we're here for. And so the idea of an ultimate age of goodness, an ultimate utopia, is consistent with that basic model of life for Jewish thought. Now, when we come to Eitz Chaim classes and you talk about doing mitzvahs and doing Jewish things, that really generally focuses on me, either as an individual or as part of a Jewish people. But when we think about Messianic Age, we usually think about not just individuals or the Jewish people, but whom?
The whole world,
right? And that is indeed the Jewish vision. That is our long-term, thousands of years old tradition that this Messianic Age is for the whole world. Ultimately, all human beings who are around at the time, whenever it happens, will share in this Messianic Age. So that's a framework to think about. So the question is, at the end, how are we going to get there, and when is it going to happen? Is going to be fueled by this whole overall model. Let's look at the picture first. First of all, what's your assumption? Raise your hand if you have an assumption of what the Messianic Age is going to look like. What's the world going to look like in your dream, in your vision, your dream? What's the Messianic Age going to look like? Yeah.
No more evil.
Well, be more specific. What do you mean by evil? No more. End of
war.
What else? What else?
Disease.
Poverty. Disease, poverty. Okay. What else?
Christ. Sacrifice.
So, end of those things, start of?
Temple. Third temple.
Someone says a temple.
Sacrifice.
And all that entails. What else?
Everybody will recognize Hashem.
God awareness. Any more ends of or starts of that you envision?
Peace.
Peace. Well, that's sort of the end of war. Sorry? End of war, start of peace. They go together. Right? It's good.
End of anti-Semitism.
Okay. End of anti-Semitism.
Lineage will be on the father's
side.
End of crime.
On the male side.
Male, start of male lineage?
Well,
end of
male is the female. You're Jew, your mother's a Jew.
Okay, that's an interesting theory. You think that you're Jewish.
You make it up.
Jewish lineage, you're certain to. Okay, interesting theory. Will we go to.
On the male side.
Patrilineal descent. Are you saying end of matrilineal descent?
Well, that's what
they said. That's what someone told you. Okay. End of matrilineal descent. Okay. Interesting. Yeah. So the peace that you're saying, that peace will be a total global harmony, peace and love, flowers in our hair, barefoot, the whole works, right? Not all that. Yeah. Sorry?
Stay young, never get old.
No, end of aging.
End of death.
End of death. That's a big one. Okay. You're thinking big here. That's good. Yes, in the back. Right here.
Oh, it's going to start with a big war, and it's going to end with a lot of questions being
asked. I thought we were going to have end of war. You're saying the start of war. Wait a second. I want to just focus a bit on. I'm not talking now about how to get to a messianic age. What is the messianic age going to look like when all the trials and tribulations are over? What's going to be? What kind of world utopia do we picture? Yes, sir.
You have to sell your house in Baltimore and buy one in Israel.
You're saying people will be. Everyone in the world will be required to move to Israel. You say Jews will be required to move to Israel. So you say 100. Am I getting it right? 100% Aliyah. Aliyah. Is that what you're saying? Okay. Okay, that's what he's saying here, right? And we have that on there.
End of crime.
End of crime. Okay, war, disease, poverty, crime. Okay, let's go down, and now if you're taking notes, let's see what the actual sources say that correspond actually to a few of these, but not to all of them. First of all, it does say in Isaiah, there's a prediction, chapter 35, that something that sounds very much like the end of disease, Isaiah says, the eyes of the blind will be opened, the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped, the lame man leap as a hart, and the tongue of the dumb shall sing. It sounds very poetic, but he's predicting, he's envisioning what some kind of messianic era will look like. And what I like to ask you, when you listen to this list, at the end of the list, I want you to tell me how many of these things require miracles to happen, and how many could happen naturally. So the first thing is, like for example, end of disease and poverty. It says in the Midrash that many forms of difficult physical labor will be ended. That was not up there. The end of certain kinds of hard labor will be ended. It says in Isaiah, the famous quote that's on the wall of the United Nations called the Isaiah Wall, the nation will no longer lift up sword against nation, nor shall they learn war no more. Just think about, there's a website called costofwar.com, and they have a running total of how much the war in Iraq is costing every second and every day. And then you can click and you can put on your hometown, your state, I mean, and it will show you, based on the population of Maryland, it will tell you what that could have bought, that money, if the money had not been spent on the war in terms of educational, health services, and so on, poverty services. And so just imagine the amount of money spent on war, regardless of how you feel about this particular war. That's not a political statement. It's just no one wants to have a war, except for maybe the arms manufacturers, but most people don't want to have a war. And think about what those resources could be used for if we did not have to spend them on that military budget. We're talking about, I don't know, $10 billion a week or something like that, or a day maybe. It's $10 million a day.
You mentioned no hard labor. Would that include birth?
Well, that's the question was, what about labor that we call, what we call labor, which is what a woman gives birth? That's actually the next item on my bullet point list here. Where in the Torah does it mention the pain of woman's labor in giving birth? In the book of Genesis, right, at the beginning, it's referred to, we call it the curse of Adam and Eve, right? Adam is cursed to have to do what? Toil the soil, in the soil, and Eve is cursed with the toil or the pain of birth. And in fact, those two do go together in the Midrash. It says, just like the toil of the labor of the man, of the man will be ended, and so too will the pain of woman in giving birth. Okay? Now, on that list of those ends of those problems, it doesn't say explicitly end of... I've never heard about this idea, by the way, matrilineal descent ending. But if you have a source for that, I'd like to see that. I've never heard of that. This is implied, although it doesn't say so explicitly. We'll see that in a few minutes. But just the thing, and also end of death, I've not heard of explicitly in the Messianic age. So I'm just going to put those in brackets for now, because I don't... think those are part of it. My question for you is, the things I just listed, which of those things require a miracle to happen and which don't?
Labor and disease.
End of labor require, end of disease require a miracle or don't require a miracle? Anyone, who agrees the end of labor and disease require a miracle? Who disagrees? Why do you disagree?
Scientific advances.
You're saying scientific advances could lead to the end of labor and to the end of disease. I would think so, but I guess it's a matter of opinion. Some people may disagree. We've eliminated a lot of diseases and a lot of labors already through technology and scientific advances. It's not so far-fetched to think that in our lifetime we could eliminate many more diseases and many more labors that people have. I don't think it's science fiction to maybe 100 or 1,000 years ago people would have thought so, but today's technologies are pretty impressive. Yeah.
Think of scientific advances as miracles.
Okay, that's a semantic choice. Right? I was speaking of miracles as opposed to science, but I don't differ with you on that. Yeah.
Well, people thought that smallpox was essentially eliminated, and then, but it turned out that I guess you know terrible smallpox was terrorism,
and
all that. There's a chance that it could come back. So I guess then it goes to, well, unless evil is eradicated. I mean,
okay.
So it actually is
coming to relate. So thank you for the segue, because we're going to move in from the end up to the start of, and let's see if that answers your point. What's going to start? Those things are what are going to end in the Messianic age. And boy, some of them are we there yet? Well, we haven't eliminated disease or war or crime or poverty. Have we reduced them at all?
Yeah.
A lot, right? It's a lot. How much? What percentage? That's a judgment call, but just something to think about. Now, what about the start of? What should start in the Messianic age? Well, first of all, this down here, I'm going to start with this idea right here. The idea of Aliyah of Jewish people to the land of Israel. It says in the Talmud in Sanhedrin, around page 97, if you're interested in sources, there are a few midrashim there about the Messianic age and what it should look like. And one of the statements there is that there will be a new political independence of Jews in the land of Israel. It further says, according to some opinions, it will be done with the permission of other nations, meaning it won't be taken by force. And there's another midrash that says Jews are not allowed to take the land of Israel by force. A famous midrash that talks about the three oaths. And one of the oaths that the Jewish people presumably took was never to take the land of Israel by force, but only to move there with the permission of the nations. And this, by the way, is a subject of dispute, which is why you've heard of Orthodox Jews who are against the state of Israel and against moving to the state of Israel. Why is that? Because they interpret that midrash to say you're not even allowed to move there at all until the Messianic age is fully there. So most authorities disagree and say that midrash only means you can't make an army and conquer from the outside. But it doesn't say, but individuals could always move there, according to authorities such as the Vilna Gaon and others. So that's what the Talmud says, and there are a lot of midrashim that say the Messianic age, you know, when you want to know when it's starting? When there's masses of Jews moving to Israel individually. Doesn't say 100%, But when there's a massive wave of Aliyah, that you will start to see that's the beginning of the Messianic Age. It also says in Ezekiel and in Sanhedrin as well that the land of Israel will be cultivated in the Messianic Age. It's not just a matter of living in cities. There will be a widespread cultivation of the land. And also that the Messiah himself, whoever that will be, will become revealed to us in the land of Israel. He's not going to show up in New York or Baltimore or anywhere else. You can look all you want and think maybe that's him. You know, it's not going to be here. If you want to be the first to see the Messiah, you've got to yourself be in Israel for that to happen. That's according to these sources. And there's some evidence that, there's some opinions that, not 100%, but a majority. That a majority of Jews should be in the land of Israel before there will be a Messianic Age. And the reason that is, that because that rule about a majority is tied to this prediction about the temple. The temple cannot function, according to this theory, unless there's a majority of Jews living in the land of Israel. So the temple will be built at some point in the Messianic Age. The question is, who's going to build it? Will it be built by this Messiah as part of the building of the Messianic Age? Or will it be built after the Messianic Age is now established and now it's being built? That's the subject of dispute. We don't know.
Another question is, that might come down from heaven.
Might. However it comes down, the question is when. Will it happen at the start of the Messianic Age or at the when the Messianic Age is in full bloom? That we don't know. But we do know there's a very important prediction that something will return to the Jewish people known as prophecy. Now, what is prophecy? You know what prophecy is? It's not telling the future. That's not what prophecy is, essentially. I mean, that's one of the symptoms of prophecy, is that we have accurate predictions about the future. But that's not essentially what prophecy is. What's prophecy? It's being what?
Bringing the word of God.
In other words, prophecy, we all get, by the way, whether or not you're awake, if you're a human being, an intelligent human being, you get messages from God every day. God's always talking to you, but just they're not clear. We don't understand them. What does it mean that I couldn't find a parking place? That mean I left too early or left too late? I don't know what the message is, right? But that was a message, I guarantee it. Prophecy is defined as messages from God that are absolutely clear and without any mistake what they mean. And that's a level of awareness that people, men and women, were once upon a time able to achieve and have not been able to achieve for the last 2,500 years. And we are told that in the Messianic Age, that a level of awareness of connection to God will again return. And it will only happen to people who are in the land of Israel. So again, you might choose if that when that age occurs, which, whether it's now or tomorrow, to stay in Baltimore. But if you want to be able to enjoy that fruit of the Messianic Age, you got to move to Israel as well. Okay. Also, the question is: will this person, the Messiah himself, will he be a prophet? Did one of your previous speakers discuss this point? This is an interesting topic. It's not necessarily. The Messiah himself does not necessarily have to be a prophet himself. But there's an old tradition, which most people have heard of at some point, it's in all the Yiddish lore, about a certain prophet coming right before the Messiah, heralding the Messiah. Who is that?
Elijah.
We call him Elijah. Why is it actually legally necessary for a prophet such as Elijah to come before there's a Messiah? Anybody know? You should know because you should have had this discussion earlier today. Not to get people ready. There's a legal reason, a technical reason why we need a prophet in order to have a Messiah. He has to anoint him, right? The word Messiah means what? Mashiach means anointed. Somebody has to pour oil on the guy's head. And only person who can do that with any authority is a certified card-carrying prophet. How do you become a certified card-carrying prophet? Well, Maimonides gives the details how to do that. That's another topic for another time. But we have to have at least one certified card-carrying prophet so we can trust that this is not a game, not a shenanigan, because we've been burned in the past by false messiahs and false prophets who claimed they were doing it. No one really checked them out enough. And skeptics were shoved to the side, and the people who were eager for this to happen, over-eager, you know, lashed on to a false prophet. It's happened a number of times in our history, not that long ago. So we have to be skeptical. But on the other hand, we do need a card-carrying prophet to make it happen. Yeah. Taking olive oil.
I understand the physical process, but anyone can take olive oil and pour it on something.
Right, but it's only relevant to us if the person who did it was a certified prophet who told us, I am anointing this person to be the king.
But the inside himself can't be a certified prophet?
Could be. I say it doesn't have to be.
Okay, so he can anoint himself.
I don't think so. I don't think he can anoint himself. That's an interesting question. I don't think so, though. Yeah. Sorry? There's a Maimonides has gives details of a test to someone who claims to be a prophet to test whether or not their claim is true. So we give him the test. If he passes the test, he's a prophet. If he doesn't pass the test, we don't listen to him. Okay? Right. Correct. There's only one test. That's the test of the prophet. Once we have a prophet, even a single prophet's enough. If he says, God has told me this person is the Mashiach, we have to listen to him.
Now, I thought there's also a tradition of two Mashiachs, right?
Okay. Yes. Yes. Let's see if we have time. Because I'm under strict orders and to end in... Okay, we might have time. Let's see if we have time for the two Messiah theory. Other comments or questions about the prophecy? Okay. So... The tradition that he will be a prophet is interesting, and there is a tradition that he will be a prophet, but not everybody agrees that he has to be a prophet. And if you want to see this, the idea about the majority of Jews living in Israel is a problem for us right now. Where do majority of Jews live right now? In Israel or outside of Israel? I'm a little bit surprised by the confidence in which you answer my question. Because I spend a lot of time, probably not that much, but I probably spend more time than average looking at these statistics and looking at the Jewish population surveys. And quite frankly, it's I can either say nobody knows or there's no right answer. Because, first of all, it depends on how you define a Jew. If a Jew is the child of a Jewish mother or a convert, let's say, if that's your definition, just take the most limited definition of Jew. The child of a Jewish woman or a convert, how many Jews should there be in the world? If you think about it, any time a woman, Jewish woman, decides to convert to Christianity, is her child Jewish?
Yes.
Of course. What about her daughter's daughter?
Yes.
When does it end? So we may have millions of Jews by that definition, by the most stringent definition around the world that we don't know about. Correct? So that's why I'm saying to answer that question with confidence is very troublesome because you can't. It depends on how you define Jew. This is an issue. If you define Jew by those who are known for sure to be Jewish by that definition, then it's very possible we already have a majority in the land of Israel today. It's very possible. The American statistics that tell you how many Jews are in New York or Baltimore are fraught with complications. The way they measure these things are very, very complicated and not very, very good and not very obvious. That they're not so simple. If you look at them, and the people who do these studies themselves admit so. Yeah, you can. If you want to have further information on this, contact me. I'll send you some info that will help you understand this better.
How do you measure?
Excuse me?
How do you measure the Baltimore in the country?
They usually measure it based on who says, I'm Jewish. Who says, I'm Jewish?
Well, you're not going to say you're Jewish.
But that's not... Exactly. There's many Jews who don't say. And there's many people who say... I just read an article about a mass conversion of thousands of Jews in one of people to Judaism in another community, that some segments of Judaism don't consider that conversion valid. But that those thousands who are just went through that are going to be counted in the next survey as Jews. But then there's other Jews who don't consider those conversions valid. So it's problematic to come up with an answer to that question. It's very possible, by a most stringent definition, that the majority of Jews already are in the land of Israel today. It's very, very possible, in my opinion. In my opinion. You're free to disagree with me. That's my opinion. Okay, I mentioned that there's a relationship between this idea of Jews going to Israel and the temple. What's the role of the temple in the Messianic age? Well, go back to my framework I gave us, that I didn't put on the board, but the purpose of life, the reason we're here in the first place is what? Let's go review that. What was the purpose that we're here according to Judaism?
To receive all love from Hashem.
In order to have a relationship to God, right? For whom to have a relationship with God? Jews only, right? No! The whole thing is for the whole world to have a relationship with God. And the idea of a temple is a focal point for the entire world to be able to concentrate their relationship to God in that way. That's the purpose of a temple. The temple is not for the Jewish people, it's for the entire world. The temple is any person, Jew or Gentile, is invited to bring offerings to the temple, invited to worship at the temple. The priests of the temple bring offerings specifically designated for the nations of the world. This one is for the Romans, and this one's for the Germans, and this one is for the Chinese. They do that. I don't know if they actually label each one that way, but they are supposed to do that. The temple is supposed to be a temple of peace for the world. The Talmud says, if the world knew, if the non-Jewish world knew what the temple did for them, they would form rings of armies around it to protect it. That's what the Talmud says. That's supposed to be the way we relate to the temple. It is not just for us, but for the whole world. But to function properly, if you look at the details, you've probably heard that there's a traditional number of mitzvot in Judaism. What's the number you heard? 613, right? About half of them have to do with the temple. I mean, that's a lot. That's a big proportion of our mitzvot. We can't even do them today because there's no temple. So if the Torah is our blueprint of how to connect, to relate to God, which is the starting point of everything Jewish, and half of that has to do with the temple, obviously the temple should be relevant to a Messianic age. I hope you hear this connection. Before I get your question, I just want to tell you three things about the temple. One, I suggested that the temple may be built at the outset of the Messianic age, or may be built already when the Messianic age is in full bloom. There is an interesting tradition that in the Yalkut that says the Messiah will be revealed to the world for the first time on the roof of the temple. Wait a second. Do you hear what that means? According to that idea, the temple will already have been built before we even know who the Messiah is. Who's going to have built it? Don't know. How could it be built? It's all speculation after that. Now, there is another tradition. Listen to the difference in what I just said. Hear the words carefully. It says in the Talmud, Jerusalem cannot be rebuilt before the ingathering of the diaspora. I'll say it again. Jerusalem cannot be rebuilt before the ingathering of the exiles. Now notice that Jerusalem is often used as a code word for the temple, but not necessarily. So something to think about when you're trying to understand it. You want to know what's coming. Is Jerusalem rebuilt yet?
Depends on what you call rebuilt.
It depends on what you call rebuilt. It's up to your definition at this point. It would seem that before, according to all these sources, it would seem that there has to be settlement of the land of Israel and Jerusalem before the Messianic age becomes in full bloom. That's the most I can say right now. It's also possible that this Messiah will accomplish some of these things before we even know he's the Messiah. It's very possible stuff's going to be happening and we'll think, wow, look what's happening. It's almost like the Messianic Age, and it will be the Messianic Age, and we won't know it until it's already there. And there is a tradition that says this, that the Messianic Age is going to surprise us. You think you've got all the pieces in place and you know it's about to happen and it's going to hit you from the other side. You're going to be looking this way for the Messiah. It's going to come from over here. You're asking when? We're not there yet. Now, you had a question in the back?
Yeah. When you said that everybody in Congress is going to sacrifice to the temple, you said
everyone could bring sacrifice to the temple, yes.
But the temple was
Sure. Yeah. The question was, did people in fact bring offerings to the temple who are not Jewish people in the past? Yes, I doubt that it was that widespread, but they certainly could, and they certainly did. Yeah.
Yeah, I have also one question. Now, in the medieval ages, the Jews in Spain, some of them, I'm not sure all, they believed the more they suffer, the closer the time to the Messiah.
The question is suffering, does our suffering accelerate the coming of the Messiah? That's a wonderful question that helps me, once again, segue down my flowchart here, down my outline, because obviously for these things to happen, we're looking at evidence of great social upheaval. For these things all to happen is going to be a great social upheaval, whether it happens slowly or quickly, right? And there's a concept in Jewish thought called Hevelei Mashiach, literally the birth pangs of the Messiah, that the Jewish people and the world, because remember, Messianic age is for the world, will undergo great challenges in order for these social changes to actually happen. And, well, we can talk about the negative, we can also talk about the positive. Here's some interesting predictions of social changes. Now, some of these, be big-minded about these. Some of these things maybe are meant literally, and some are maybe meant metaphorically. For example, it says in the Talmud that in the Messianic age, there will be giant fruits. Giant fruits. Like, apples the size of, the size of basketballs, and so on. Now, does that mean literally that there will be giant fruits? Maybe. It's not completely far-fetched with scientific development and so on. It could be it's meant literally, or it could mean that fruits is meant as a metaphor for people's the production and what they produce spiritually. It says also that there will be trees that produce fruit continuously 12 months out of the year. Again, scientifically, it could happen, I guess. In fact, I heard that in Israel, Israel's become the second largest producer of flowers in the world. You know how they do it? They figured out how they can get three growing seasons out of a single bulb. They put the bulb in a greenhouse, get flowers, outside, give it a winter, back in the greenhouse, and outside, and back in the greenhouse. They can do that three times in a year, and they can get three growing seasons out of the same bulb. So to have this prediction that there will be trees producing fruit the whole year doesn't all of a sudden seem so far-fetched scientifically, but it may be a metaphor as well. It is a prediction in the Zohar that the Messianic age will be accompanied by space flight. It says, and I'm going to quote extensively because this is a fantastic quote, it says in the Zohar, in the 600th year of the 6,000, you mentioned 6,000, the gates of wisdom on high and the wellsprings of lower wisdom will be opened. This will prepare the world to enter the 7,000, just as man prepares himself towards sunset on Friday for the Sabbath. It is the same here. And a mnemonic for this is from Genesis chapter 7, in where it says, in the 600th year, all the what happened in the 600th year in Genesis chapter 7? It was the flood, the great flood. All the foundations of the great deep were split. That's a hint, midrashically, to this prediction. Here, the Zohar continues, we see a clear prediction. That's not Zohar, this is me now speaking. Here in this, we see a clear prediction that in the Jewish year 5600, or which would correspond to what year? 5600 equals 1840. There's predictions, or that in 1840, the wellsprings of lower wisdom would be open, and there would be a sudden expansion of secular knowledge. Although, was there any major scientific breakthrough in 1840? I'm not aware of in 1840 a specific, development, but that certainly was right in the heart of the scientific age. The general scientific and industrial revolutions all, both really were coming to a head at that, flourishing at that time. It also is a prediction in Isaiah we quoted Isaiah before about war. Isaiah also predicts in chapter 62 that there will be social justice. People will not be taken advantage of. This is on the positive side. These are positive things that are predicted the Messianic age will look like. Now, the social upheaval that I referred to that has to get us there is the Chevle Mashiach. There are three things that I'd like you to focus on in this prediction. Three types of social upheaval that are predicted. Number one, there's a prediction that parents and children will stop getting along with each other. That the young generation will no longer respect the older generation. The world will be changing so rapidly that parents and older people will not be respected. The old will have to seek favors from the young. A man's own children will become his enemies. Insolence will increase. People will no longer have respect, and parents will no longer know how to give reproof to their children. That's number one. Number two, not only social upheaval, but religious. Judaism will suffer. Religious studies will be despised and actually be used by non-believers to strengthen their arguments. The government will become totally godless, academies, places of immorality, and the religious people will be denigrated. These are all predictions in the Talmud and the Zohar. Judaism will suffer greatly. Judaism specifically will suffer, and there's a tradition that Jews will be split into various groups, each one claiming to have the true Judaism and calling the other ones not true Judaism. And this is what Isaiah meant in his prophecy. The Talmud says Isaiah meant this in 59:15 when he says, truth will fail because we won't have a sense. What's the right Judaism? They're all competing for authenticity. And the third prediction that's, I think, important for you to know, it's been predicted that many Jews will just leave Judaism entirely. This is how the sages of the Midrash and medieval times understood Daniel chapter 12, when Daniel says, the wicked shall do wickedly and not understand. Meaning, not understand means they're going to be totally ignorant about their Judaism, just walk away from it. These are the things that are predicted are going to get us to here. Now, we talked about the temple. What about God awareness? And what about social harmony? Global harmony. Well, those are, I think, are actually subheadings of the temple. By definition, what the temple means is not simply a physical building. It's a focal point, as I said, for God awareness, and the whole world will be focused on a spiritual pursuit. Once we get rid of hard, back-breaking labor and women's labor pains and birth, once we get rid of disease and crime and poverty and war, we have all this extra time on our hands. We either spend it, you know, playing video games and watching football games, or we spend it on something more meaningful, which is pursuit of wisdom and transcendence. And that's what the Jewish view is. The Jewish view of the Messianic age is that we'll have the opportunity, and those who will be left around, those who will be the most valued, are going to be not the ones who can play basketball the best, and not the ones who can act on TV the best, but those who have wisdom to help people, other people achieve connection to God. Those who have the prophecy, those who have the Torah. And that's where that's the ultimate prediction, that someone predicted anti-Semitism would go away. Not only will it go away, it'll be a flourishing of philo-Semitism, because it'll be recognized that the Torah that the Jews have is not the Torah of the Jews. The Torah of the Jews is the Torah of the world. The Jews have been the caretakers of it for 3,000 years. But the Torah is the source of all goodness in the world, and we happen to have been given this as our mission to perpetuate it and protect it and teach it. And therefore, those of us who have access to it, have taken the time to take a hold of the Torah, which is yours, will be the ones who are have the highest currency. Now, I mentioned that I asked you a few minutes ago how many mitzvahs there are in the Torah, and you all answered me, what was the answer? 613. That's actually a lie. It's not 620 either. It's good to come to a class and you spend a whole day in a seminar and you learn something finally, right? after so many hours. So I'm gonna, if you walk away with anything today, I hope you'll walk away with this one piece of wisdom. This is probably the most important thing you'll hear all day. It's not true that there are 613 mitzvahs in the Torah. The correct number of mitzvahs in the Torah is 613 times the number of Jews. Now, I'm not saying that to be cute. The idea is that my mitzvahs affect you, and your mitzvahs affect me. We are connected karmically to each other. And if there's a Jew out there, and that is whether you or me or anyone else, who is choosing not to do a mitzvah they're able to do, it affects all of us and keeps all of us from this era of utopia. On the other hand, if there's a Jew out there who says, you know, I haven't lit Shabbat candles in a long time, I'm going to try lighting them. Wow, that might be the straw that broke the back of the pain and suffering got us to that. Every mitzvah counts, and every bit of wisdom you learn counts. So it's incumbent upon, if you care about this happening, not just to fantasize about it, and not just to talk about it and dream about it, but to take responsibility for your own share of the Torah and your own share of Judaism, and for those you have the ability to influence, whether that be your children, or your neighbors, or your grandchildren, or whether that means giving tzedakah to a Jewish organization that is doing that for you as your messenger. Whatever it is, make sure that you are taking responsibility for your share of Judaism and not just becoming a bystander. Those who do take responsibility for their share, whether they're in Baltimore or in Israel, will be able to enjoy the fruits of the Messianic age, we hope and believe. Those who don't, we don't want to think about that. We want everyone to take their share. Yeah.
When does
The question is, there's a fundamental, Maimonides lists fundamental principles of belief for Jewish people to have, like the idea there's a God running the world, those principles. One of them is to believe there's going to be a messianic age. That's a fundamental part of the Jewish creed, that there's going to be one at some point. Another one is that there will be a resurrection of people who have passed away. The question is, when will that happen on the timeline? Will that happen before the Messianic Age, during, or after? Well, it's one of those things where I have to say we don't know. There are several pages in the Talmud in Sanhedrin discusses this question. First of all, how do we know it's going to happen and what's the source of it and so on? Because there's no explicit reference in the Torah to it. And the most opinions that I've seen believe it will happen after the Messianic Age. In other words, the Messianic Age and all this stuff will happen before there will be any resurrection of the dead. Another question. Someone had their hand up over here. Yeah, yeah, back there.
Yeah, two things I'm wondering. I don't know, is there any type of prediction of when this might happen? We assume it will happen in our lifetime. And I do wonder if, like the Christians said, Jesus, we have just like a man who will come in the flesh of a man to be Messiah. How will we know?
I didn't fully understand your second question.
We have like a man, like the Christians, Jesus came. Will we have a man from the Jewish perspective come in the flesh of a man?
Will the Messiah person be a physical human being? Is that your question?
Yeah.
Yes. The Messiah, okay, I'm glad you asked that question. That'll help me answer your first question. First of all, those who are here all day should have got this, but make sure we got it clear. The Messiah, the Jewish view of Messiah, is a physical, flesh and blood human being who is a great leader, who is a charismatic person, who is a great scholar, who is Jewish, who is a great Torah scholar, who unifies the Jewish people, to whom every Jew can look at and say, I could follow that person. It's that would be a miracle, right? I mean, we've all found charismatic leaders in present and past times that we thought, well, that's a great leader, but we never found one that we all agreed on. Just imagine one who's so wise and so kind and so inspiring that everyone can look at him and say, I can follow that guy. That guy I could follow. That's the kind of person we envision. And I'll get to you in a second. And that vision of that person is a real flesh and blood person, not a god, a demigod, an actual person who was born to two parents and grew up in a Jewish family. Where he's going to come from, we don't know. I stated today, he's supposed to be revealed to us in the land of Israel. Now, the other question is, when is this all going to happen? Well, I asked you this in the beginning. Well, it depends on how we define it. Is the Messianic Age, according to these criteria, has it possibly already begun? You want to know, when is the person going to be revealed to us? When are we going to see, there, that's the Messiah? Well, according to one of the predictions I read to you, not until it's already over. Not until there's already a temple standing. When is that going to happen? Is that going to happen in our lifetime? I'd like to share with you this prediction from the Midrash in the name of Rabbi Elazar, who says the following. The Messianic Age will begin in a generation. Now think about this in terms of the past 2,000, 3,000 years, when this could first have taken place. The Messianic Age will begin in a generation with the power to destroy itself. All the predictions in Ezekiel and Zechariah about the war and the apocalypse and the Gog and Magog, which are all there, and Eitz Chaim, if you're really interested in that stuff, we can give a class on it. Those don't necessarily have to happen. Those are potential ways we'll get to Messianic Age. What I've tried to give you is a picture of a Messianic Age and a challenge for you to help make it happen sooner. You know, if you can really picture this, and you're here today and you've taken the time out of your day off to come here, that means you care. And the question is then, as I said a minute ago, how are you going to take that inspiration tomorrow and help make this age come? Will you be a Jew who's more connected and take even one small step closer? Would you like some guidance in that? So Rabbi Lando just returned, and he's in the back of the room ready to take your name and give you ideas of how you can deepen your Jewish connection and your Jewish learning. I hope.
The Messiah will just come to the Jews, correct?
No. The whole world. I would like to. I'd like to conclude by asking you. First of all, I have evaluation forms for this session. I always like to pass them out for my own sessions. I have flyers so you can put on your fridge. And remember, if you'd like to learn about the relationship between Judaism and Islam, take one of these, please. I'll pass those out. And if you would like, one last thing. If you would like to receive, when I put this lecture on the internet, the audio, if you'd like to get an email from me telling you that it's available to download or to share with somebody else, please give me your email address on this form, and I'll be happy to give you that info when it comes out. I want to thank all of you for sticking it out until so many hours of your day on your day off. And thank you, Chaim, for hosting this, and hope to see you all again. I'll take some questions right now. People like to stay. I can stay for a few more minutes. If you can't stay, thank you for coming. But those who are staying, please keep the voices down so everyone can hear the answers. The question was just asked. You're free to leave. I mean, you're not a captive audience. You can't go. That's fine. The question was just asked about two messiahs. This was asked before. I wanted to answer this. Will there be one or two messiahs? Very good question. I'll try to answer it like this. We know
that the stories of Tanakh are there to teach us about patterns of Jewish history. Messiah is supposed to be a king, a person we look to as an actual king. King with a crown on his head, or a real human king. And he's modeled, we understand him to be something like King David, the ideal king. Was King David the first king of Israel?
No.
No. There was a king before King David named Saul or Shaul. So just like before King David, there was a predecessor king. Many say before our final king Messiah, there will be a predecessor king.
that will be descended not from Judah, as King David is, but from
Joseph.
Well, Saul wasn't from Joseph, he was from Benjamin, but close enough. Okay, some say. Because Joseph and Benjamin were both children of the same parents. They were both full brothers. So there's some playing with that, massaging of that midrash a little bit. However, now this is interesting. This is interesting. By the way, this is where Christianity gets this idea of an antichrist coming before the Christ. 99% of what they believe comes from Judaism in some way. Their idea of an antichrist is what we teach about the Messiah, son of Joseph, coming first, and then him being killed, and then followed by a Messiah, son of David. Some say you can identify the Messiah, son of Joseph, based on what he does. What did Saul, the first Messiah, son of Joseph, do in order to pave the way for King David? Number one, he placated much of the enemies of the Jews in the land of Israel. That was the primary thing he did. Number two, he created some sense of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel. And then he was killed off, and King David then was the king. And King David was the final unifier of the Jews. Some have suggested, this is all theory, nobody, this is speculation because nobody knows, that the role of Messiah, son of Joseph, has already been fulfilled by what? The state of Israel. The nation state of Israel, which is done good and some not so good for the Jewish people and for the world, has done some of these things. It has created Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel, not totally, and created a defense against some enemies of the Jews in the land of Israel. In the time of Saul and David, what were those enemies called?
Philistines.
What are they called today?
Palestinians.
And the name Palestinian comes from Philistine, by the way. That's the name the Romans called them. That's what they call themselves. They're proud to be Philistines. In fact, some of them claim they're descendants of the original Philistines. I don't think they're right, but that's what they claim. They're trying to give themselves authenticity in the land, right? Well, in our reading, that gives them inauthenticity. But okay, they want to claim that, let them claim it. But that's just to answer your question. Again, if someone has to go, feel free to go. You're not being rude, but any other questions? Yeah.
The second part is, how much time between the two
signs? Well, in the book of Samuel, they overlap. King David is anointed while Saul is still alive. So if that's our model, it would sound to me, I'm speculating, that the Messiah, son of David, will come when there's still a state of Israel. But the state of Israel eventually will be replaced by the kingdom of the temple and the Torah. Won't be a state of Israel. It'll be land of Israel, not a state of Israel.
Oh.
Yeah, sir. So let me just get his question here. If it's so central, the question is, how come none of this is in the Torah itself, but only, well, it's in the Tanakh. And it is in the Torah. It actually is in the Torah. It is in the Chumash. Sure.
Where?
The blessings of Jacob,
the
blessings.
Okay. Let me take your answer and interpret it for it. It says there's a blessing Jacob gives to Judah on his deathbed that has been interpreted midrashically to refer to a kingdom, a messianic kingdom. Your question is there anything more explicit than that? Okay? And I hesitate to go, I'll tell you, I'm going to answer your question. The answer is yes. But I want to challenge the foundation of your question. Because traditionally, we look at the oral Torah as valid as written Torah, not as something secondary. And I hear an unspoken assumption behind your question that you want something more valid, like something in the written Torah. And I challenge that assumption. Because what came first, oral Torah or written Torah?
Oral.
Oral for sure came first, and I can show you proof of that. Oral Torah precedes written Torah.
Yes. So it's a mistaken, I think, assumption. But anyway, there is an explicit mention in the written Torah about how to set up, how to, the laws of kings, of Jewish kings. And Maimonides takes that and details it and details all the laws of kings, how to crown a king and what a king can do, what a king cannot do, his powers, etc. The balance of power between the king and the Sanhedrin and so on. That's what we're talking about here. We're talking about a kingdom. Do you hear this? We're not talking about a son of God. We're talking about a flesh and blood human being who's crowned king. That's explicitly written about in the Torah. It's not not merely a midrash. There's also midrashim and other things, but it's also written in the written Torah.
This person comes from a natural mother and father,
correct?
Correct.
Okay. Yes, other questions?
In future time of the arrival of the Messiah, it will most likely be a large present Christian population of the world. Do you see them any value in having a bipartisan committee approach that man and ask him a single question? Have you been here before?
No. No, I'll tell you why. Because when the Messiah comes, the flourishing of the Messianic age. By the way, there's a camera right behind you. If you wouldn't mind just... it's only on me. No one else is being recorded. But if there's good video, we might put a little clips on YouTube. That's okay. The flourishing of Torah wisdom will belie any falsehood automatically. People will see at that time that the prediction that Jews are going to be, not Jews, Christians are going to be swept up to heaven immediately, you know, and so on, and that Jews will be all destroyed as the Muslims believe, these predictions will be, people will see they just weren't not correct, and therefore the whole system of thought known as Christianity or as Islam or other system of thought themselves will be shaken asunder, because according to Christian and Muslim belief, especially Muslim belief, and I'll talk about this in January, if one tenet is false, the whole thing falls apart. All you have to do is disprove, in black and white terms, one tenet of Christianity or Islam, and the whole thing falls apart. So no one's going to have to do it. It won't have to be irrelevant. It'll be a big shocker for them, that's for sure. It's going to be a day of enlightenment for the whole world. Yeah?
A very intelligent colleague of mine, who's a strong Christian, when he heard a comment about two messiahs, Jewish two messiahs, he thought that fit in perfectly with Christianity.
Sure, where do you think they got it from? 95% of Christianity comes from Judaism. Right? The authors of Christianity were what kind of people?
Jews.
They were Jewish people. Christianity is an attempt to modernize Judaism to 2,000 years ago vision of things. That's what it is. So that's not a surprise. That should be obvious to us. Maybe it's a shocker to him, right? But Jesus and his followers were religious Jews who kept kosher, who circumcised their children, etc. There's a movement among some Christians today to try to live more like biblical Jews because they recognize if I follow Jesus, I should be maybe acting more like Jesus. Well, that means I have to stop eating pork. They don't want to go that far. Yeah. Yeah, that's just another... There's lots of beliefs. Every miracle attributed to Jesus in the Christian Bible has a precedent in the Tanakh. Every single one. Walking on water, raising the dead, feeding the hungry, everything. There's nothing original in those terms, in terms of the apocalypse. It's nothing. It's all written by Jews who knew about Judaism. Jews who are very connected. Yeah. Can't hear you. Where's the walking on water? I think it was in the Book of Kings. I can show you the reference later. Yeah.
Two things.
One more question, then we'll wrap up.
Okay, two things. You were talking about how to define a Jewish person. A lot of assimilation is that one male or female that's marrying a Jew, marrying a Jew.
Yeah.
According to the Reform Judaism, I don't know whether conservative, they are, their offspring is Jewish. If one parent is Jewish. So how will you define... They won't marry them, but they're allowed to go to religious school if one of the parents is Jewish. So how do you define a Jew?
You ask me how I
population.
You ask me how I personally define Jewish?
Well, you're coming from the premise of Orthodoxy, but we have other, we have conservative, we have.
Well, Reform Jews. Well, let's take Reform as a, and I'll just make it this last answer. Reform Judaism doesn't believe in the same kind of messianic era that we're discussing here. They don't believe in the rebuilding of a temple. They don't believe in the abolition of democracy in the land of Israel and the institution of a monarchy. They don't believe in that. So it's all irrelevant to them. Until 1948, Reform Judaism was against even Jews going to Israel. They thought the New Jerusalem was either Berlin or New York. Now, they've changed. The Reform movement has changed since then. But it's sort of an irrelevant question to them. Whether or not there's patrilineal, matrilineal, they can define however they want. All this is based on Talmud and Maimonides, which your average Reformed Jew is not reading or interested in. That's all, okay? I don't want to end on a negative note. I would like to say that people come to me and I don't know if their mother's Jewish or father's Jewish or they're a convert. Well, I don't really care. I don't ask those questions. People come to my class. I'm not so interested in their background. I teach anybody who comes, and that's Eitz Chaim's general policy as well. We're not trying to weed out. That's not our job. Our job is to make the Torah available, and your job is to learn it. So have a great day, and I appreciate coming.